This piece was brought to you by Roberta's, robertaspizza.com.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. Last month, Hurricane Florence walloped parts of North Carolina. According to the Weather Channel, it was the wettest tropical storm to ever hit the Tar Heel State. So how did the restaurant industry respond? Some helped FEMA weather the storm, while others got to work feeding people on the ground.
We just walked in and said, we know how to cook, what can we do? They said, I need you guys to just cook 150 pork loins, and we were just like, okay.
Now the attention needs to be on Florence's long-term effect on North Carolina's farming community.
The general mood of farmers is one of certainly resilience and almost feels like it's the normal course of business to just get hit by a gigantic hurricane and need to just keep on going.
So tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, 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 welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, guys, it's Tuesday, October 16th. I'm Jimmy Carboni, the host of Beer Sessions Radio. And this is a special week. It's New York Rye Week in New York City. But we're going to be talking a little bit about spirits and meads and mixing cocktails today in kind of honor of New York Rye Week. And we're not doing rye whiskeys. You got it. But this is a good chance to really talk about the diversity and so much progress that's happened in New York State in terms of farm licenses and ciders and whiskeys and beer and meads. And our very special guest I've been waiting to have on for a while, Raphael Lyon, Enlightenment Mead, no, Wine Meadery. You're going to tell me. Now you're going to repeat it for me and I'm not going to screw up.
Enlightenment Wines Meadery. It used to just be Enlightenment Wines, but all we made was mead, so we felt like we needed to clarify.
And we got your friend Patrick from Duke's Liquor Box in Greenpoint, Brooklyn.
Yep, that's correct. Thank you for inviting me here.
Yeah. So this is really your show. But so again, we're going to talk a little bit about New York State licenses and what's changed and how you're able to really operate. And that it also applies to independent liquor stores, and we'll talk about meads and the history of meads and some other products. So let's get started. So, I think we all first met around 2009.
Mm-hmm.
So give us a backstory on opening a meadery.
Wow, yeah, that's true. So in 2009, I got a license for a farm winery. And in New York, that basically means that in exchange for using New York State ingredients, 100% New York State ingredients, you get certain privileges as a wine producer. And they mostly mean that you can sell directly to people like you with restaurants, things like that. So that's nice if you're just starting out and you want to make a small amount and sell directly to the public. At the time, I was doing an almost entirely subscription-based meadery. So if you were in Napa, they'd call it like a cult winery. And to be clear, I think, because we'll use this word meadery and winery sort of interchangeably, and I think that can be confusing for people, but essentially mead is honey wine. It's a kind of wine, just like there's rice wine called sake, and there's barley wine, and there's fruit wines. Mead is honey wine, so that would mean that it's not a grape wine that you add honey to. It's a fermented beverage made out of honey and usually water or fruit juice or honey and herbs.
And there's one, I was doing a little research today, there's a New Yorker article where basically it says rather than like the Dungeon and Dragon style, mm-hmm. When we think of mead, yours is more like floral and dry.
Yeah, it's part of the challenge and also the kind of interesting thing about making mead is that for something that people haven't really tried often, they have a lot of ideas about it, right? So, if I tell you I'm going to go to the wine store and buy a wine, you kind of have some idea. It's like, well, it's going to be red, maybe, and made out of grapes. But you understand that there's sweet wines and there's crappy wines that, you know, cost, you know, $2 chuck, and there's really fine wines.
There's some more mass-produced meads that are more sweet.
Right, and it's true for mead, too. So if you're making meads, there's a whole world of very inexpensive, you know, sweet, carbonated stuff, and it's, you know, I don't like it. And then there's, on the other side of the spectrum, is people like us who, you know, we use old world wine techniques and we're making things in barrels and it takes years and you age it. And, you know, in our case, we're also using spontaneous fermentation. So it's wild yeast. We're not using sulfites. We don't filter. So in a lot of ways, the meads that we're making, they are a lot more like the way that mead probably would have been made for 10,000 years. And, you know, you have to try it, I think, to understand it. But I think if you haven't had a mead before and you're kind of trying to understand what it is, you might think of like some kind of white wine sort of strength. And in the case of our table meads, you know, the kind of thing you'd have a glass of, you know, maybe 4 or 5 ounces, like a wine glass. But also the cool thing about mead is that it's also wrapped up in herbal traditions. So if you like vermouths and you like Amaros and you like bitters and you like things that you mix cocktails with, a lot of the meads we make are also sort of like that. So we have a dandelion mead. It's basically a digestif. It's very bitter. We'll do a cherry and botanicals.
That's one of my favorites.
I brought it. We're releasing the Floralia, which is sort of like a late summer mead that's lavender, juniper, and marjoram. And again, you wouldn't necessarily drink like a whole glass of that at a meal, but you might have a 2 ounce pour and sip it. Or you might go over to Patrick's place and buy some kind of fancy gin and, you know, mix it up into a cocktail. So about half of our meads are sort of geared towards the cocktail world, and the other half are kind of we do a sparkling Pet Nat, a little bit more like a table wine.
No, that's really interesting. And why did you choose to make mead instead of a cider or another more obvious product?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think, you know, I grew up in upstate New York, and I grew up, you know, actually at working at a farm, and you know, I packed apples with Jamaicans, you know, as a teenager, and like, you know, it was really like we're surrounded by apple orchards there. And I definitely made cider. We still make a cider for Honey's, our tasting room, but I just didn't feel like cider had the range, the creative range that mead does. There's really just an enormous palette to work with, because in the case of cider, you're basically, you have your varietal apples that you can work with, which are interesting, and then sort of your production techniques, which, you know, whether or not you're doing wild or not. And you can kind of push it around. There's certainly some range to cider. But mead is like, you've got cherries, you've got elderberries, you've got black currants, then you've got all the herbs that grow, you've got yarrow, and you've got fir, and, you know, there's just all these wild, awesome things that you can work with. And then I'm also a forager, so it's fun for me to go out and pick wild juniper or rose hips or something like that and incorporate them into the mead. And it just felt like a little bit more of a, has more breath. And then also when I started, it takes up less space, because cider's maybe, you know, your cider's going to be around 6% alcohol usually. And at that kind of alcohol level, you know, it's, especially if you're doing a natural process, it's sort of asking a turn of vinegar. You got to be a little bit more sterile, a little more careful. It doesn't necessarily age as well. When you move up to about a 12% kind of table wine strength product, then, you know, basically it sterilizes itself. Not maybe, you know, it sanitizes itself, I guess is the right word, once it's wine. So it doesn't have to be so sterile. It gets better as it gets older. If it's made well, and that's nice too, you know, it takes some of the pressure off of moving it really fast. So there's a lot of things. Also, we have great honey here in New York. We've got great apples and great cherries, and we have all this great fruit, and I kind of wanted to work with everything.
Let's taste through your products. You know, think of the progression you're going to do with us. And Patrick, okay. So one thing I love about Raphael, everyone around him is a quality person. So when we were booking the show, we wanted someone that the retailer or bar owner that represented his products. So how did you meet Raphael, and what are some of his products that you sell at Duke's Liquor Box? Because you're like a real specialty destination liquor store.
We are. Thank you. Well,
right in Greenpoint, right?
In Greenpoint, Brooklyn. Yeah, that's right. I should say Raphael introduced himself to me 5 or so years ago, I think, when we had just barely opened our shop, and he walked in the door and said, I'm Raphael and I make mead. Would you like to try some? And I said, sure. And then he said, I'll be right back. And he went to his car and he came back with like an assortment of probably 8 different varieties of mead. And my experience with mead at the time was minuscule at best. And he pulled out all these different varieties and started rattling off what they were. And we started tasting through some of them. And he says, I should let you know that none of these are for sale. You can't buy any of this. And I said, okay, what can I buy here? And he said, well, maybe this one. Okay, maybe this one too. And we went through a few more. And I just said, I'll take whatever, you know, whatever we can get our hands on. And that was my first experience with the broad of category of meat, I should say. When before that, I thought it was just fermented honey, and it's way more than that. And we started working with it back when, I guess it was the Floralia, the Dandelion. I don't remember if there was a sparkling one back then.
Should we taste the Floralia now?
We should do the sparkling one first, because it's the lightest, yeah.
Yeah, and then how do you sell them? It's a category, as I said, some people think Dungeons and Dragons when you hear mead. I know that what Raphael makes is something very different.
Sure.
But how else do you describe this product?
Well, first of all, if you've never been to our shop before, unfortunately it can be a little bit intimidating because we don't have any name brands that step out right away and are recognizable. But we can always bring something to the table that's within a category of anything someone asks for usually. So the way it works out is either maybe 1 out of 100 people that walk through our door ask us for mead, and the rest don't really know what it is, or they're led to it based on if they come in looking for something unique or interesting. But like Raphael mentioned, a lot of these fit very well within somewhere of the vermouth amaro modifier category. So for example, there's a product called Dagger, which I think is still available, or maybe not, but I love that product with mezcal. We do that a lot. So when somebody's adventurous and looking into mezcal and looking at something to do with it that's different, we always bring up the Dagger and talk about it that way. Vermouths.
That's really cool that you've matched one of his, I call them mixers, with a specific spirit like mezcal.
Yeah, you kind of need to. I mean, we have to do it at the cocktail bar. I mean, my partner Arlie usually does that, or the staff, but. Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, just because something might be good for mixing doesn't mean it's good for mixing with everything. And
true.
And finding that right level of, you know, relationship is really important. So Dagger is super complicated. It's a cherry mead. It's got fir in it and
hemlock.
And hemlock. So these are like big kind of Christmas nose smells. And then, you know, yarrow, it's quite bitter. There's just a lot going on. So, you know, you need to meet that complexity with something else, often like as complex, and it has to fit like a puzzle, you know.
And I think and they go really well together. I think
a little smoky mezcal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That sounds good already.
Yeah, it's great. And I would say, like, also, we, you know, once we get to know our clients and know that kind of what they're getting into, we take that opportunity to introduce something like like the Floralia or the sparkling or the fade.
We just poured the sparkling, so let's talk us through that, Raphael.
Okay, so this is called Raise the Roof.
It's really good.
It is something I made by accident once, and then spent the following years trying to reproduce it. But
happens a lot to you, doesn't it? Because I was one of your first customers at Jimmy's Number 43, and I remember coming in. We bought carboys from you real experimental stuff.
Yeah. This is. Now we're making, I made 500 gallons of this, so the level of experimentation has to be sort of dialed in, but it's very hard to make this. I'm very proud of this because it's very hard to make. And the reason it's hard is because it's two living organisms. You've got a lactobacillus, which is not, like, you've got a sour beer here. I can tell what that organism is. These sours that are used in beers they're usually like one strain. They're very lemony. They have a kind of single note, and they're a little bit boring. So we developed our own sort of lactose strain for this. So, and you know, it's got a big, like, kind of milk nose, smells like ice cream, and that's living in the honey, eating the honey, and doing what it's doing, producing lactic acid, at the same time that the yeast is, like, kind of waking up from the honey, the thousands of different kinds of yeast, and they're all sort of developing and sort of fighting it out, and it's all happening at once. It's like a whole ecosystem. And that has to ferment out to be dry, right? Because you have to get the right amount of residual sugar in there so that we can bottle it. And it continues to ferment in the bottle and hopefully produces enough gas to produce sparkling something. And, you know, we got it pretty close. I mean, it could be a little more bubbly, but I really like it. And, we're killing this at the bar. It's sour, but it's not super sour. It should be pretty balanced, I think. And it's alive, you know, you're drinking a living
thing. Right on. I mean, also this, I feel like with all of your, even your table meads, they also make good mixers. Don't you think so, Patrick?
I would say so as well. Even this, though, is one of my favorite sparkling ones I think you've ever made. I agree. It's really special.
But you can use this for a topper.
As a topper, but I would also argue you could use this as the base and modify it slightly by adding something as a spritz into it.
Yeah.
And keeping this as your as the backbone.
Patrick, let's talk through that. So you've got Enlightenment sparkling. Is that
it's called Raise the Roof is the,
Raise
is the
the
name
roof.
Of the bottle, yeah.
Sparkling. And you're going to use it as a base, and then what would you top it with?
I would add a light bitter liqueur into it. It's like a spritz. Think of it as the same way, you know.
And you can play with the color. It's so the color's so light too.
The color is really light, yeah. Yeah, but I would treat it like a spritz. That's kind of what I would do with that, and I'd be a little more selective with the aperitif or bitter liqueur that I would add to it.
We should mention, by the way, that we've invited Patrick to come to our tasting room, which is called Honey's, which is off the Jefferson L, and he'll be there on Thursday.
Correct.
As a guest bartender, so he's going to play around
this week.
Yeah, this week. Yep. So the day after tomorrow.
Yep.
So if you want to come and try this stuff out and you live in New York,
if you're listening live,
just look up Enlightenment Wines and you'll find us, and then or look up Honey's Brooklyn, and he'll be there in the evening. You know what time?
Sure. I think probably most of the evening, but okay. I think definitely between 7 and 9.
Okay. Cool.
That's what I was going to get to is you must have a few other ideas in mind that you're going to serve that night.
There are, and in fact, we're gonna discuss a little bit of that further. A few of them, I think, we're gonna play around with beforehand, but I think there's definitely some staple ones that work really well that we'll go through with.
Yeah, I'm excited. I mean, I hope we haven't made a cocktail for this year's Floralia, so which you don't probably even have yet, right? Because we haven't started selling it quite. This one.
No, I. Well, I mean,
let's pop that next. So the Floralia, we've always had it.
So this one I've made several years in a row. And
when was this batch released?
This just came out. I mean, we just bottled this. Just listening to it. We just bottled this. So because...
That's brilliant. You said you're listening to it. What are you listening for?
I want to make sure it's not carbonating. Begin blowing up in people's faces. Because we don't sulfite these. So they have to be bone dry. And at that level of sugar, you know, if they start re-fermenting in the bottle, you get problems. So you want to make sure that when you open it, it's not fizzing too much or anything like that.
Let's pour that out. And we're going to take a short break. Back in a minute on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
My name is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
Thank you, Brandon Hoy. All right, Roberta's Pizza. We're back here in Bushwick. Thanks so much for having us. It's our ninth year on Beer Sessions Radio, and it's a great place to come. I want to give a shout-out again. It's New York Rye Week, if you're listening live. A lot of cool things happening, especially at New York Distilling in Williamsburg and Van Brunt Stillhouse in Red Hook. So just check those out online. But because it's New York Rye Week, we kind of got inspired thinking more about other spirits and mixers and New York products that have benefited from, you know, some of the farm winery, farm brewery licenses. And one of them is Raphael Lyon and Enlightenment Wines Meadery, which yes. also has a tasting room, Honey's, in Brooklyn. So we got Patrick from Duke's Liquor Box here too. So let's keep going. So this is the Floralia. It's your, tell us what that is. It's beautiful. It's floral. Mm-hmm. It's kind of bitter.
As I was saying, every year it sort of shifts around a little bit because we're using foraged herbs in some cases, and you know, just the way, you know, the lavender. It's a mead. It's a dry mead. We use a very light honey, so it's pretty delicate.
Lavender. That's what pops.
Yeah. So then we've got a lavender, juniper, and marjoram. The juniper is it's quite complicated, actually. You can't just throw these things in there. You know, the juniper needs to be heated to release the things. On the other hand, the lavender, if you heat it, it becomes very bitter. So it's quite a complicated infusion. And again, there's just like any wine, there's seasonal variations, and some years have particular vintages, and, you know, it just moves around a little bit each year, which I think is great. I think one of the things, especially if you're a beer drinker out there listening to this, and, there's certain questions that are going to pop into your head right away that I think that's important, that I've learned when talking to beer drinkers about mead and really ultimately about wine and then also natural wine, is that, we're not necessarily looking, like, beer has always been made in a factory. Home brewing is a kind of modern invention. It happened in the post-war era, but beer is old, right? But beer's always been made in factories. You go back to Egypt, there's a factory making beer. People aren't making it in their houses. That's not true for all alcohols. You know, distilling, for example, you know, people drinking a distilled product, it was always a business. No one was doing that in their backyard. Wine, however, has always been made, or generally has always been made, at least partially by small landowners and people in their homes. Mead also. Mead you can make in a bucket. You can make a really good mead in a bucket. You can't make a really good beer in a bucket. Beer gets better as you get larger equipment, generally. Wine doesn't necessarily. Wine often is better when you make it in smaller batches. And there's reasons for that, and I can get into them, but the result is that the culture around wine and the culture around the kind of mead that I want to make, which is a kind of wine sensibility, is not looking for consistency, it's looking for character, right? So what the goal, for example, of a wine is to, you know, often express a place and time or a certain sensation or a certain set of flavors, and you're looking for balance and drinkability and all those kind of things, but it's totally legitimate to make a wine that's very difficult to drink, right? That you might just have little sips of and take your time with and really have to, it's difficult. I don't know if you really want a really difficult beer. You know, it's not really the goal of beer, right? And one of the things that has been a challenge for us is that in the world of mead, most commercial mead is made by brewers, and they're people with beer backgrounds, and they haven't been able to make the jump of understanding that it's really a wine product.
Is there... Sorry to interrupt, but you've said that twice now, like commercial mead producers.
I'm commercial. Familiar. We're commercial, but
right. But I mean, is there like I don't find there to be competition necessary. Not that it's not an equal playing space with other meaderies. Mm-hmm. But I mean, is there really like a commercial? Is there a large industry for mead that I'm just not seeing because
there is. Yeah. So when
I mean, there's a bigger producer that we've had on the show, Moonlight Meadery.
Moonlight's big, but even Moonlight's not. But they're not. It's not like the Moonlight's still trying to make a kind of wine. What's happened is that because there's always this American appetite for like a sparkling alcoholic beer strength something, like whether it be Zima, or whether or not it be like quote mead, which is
malt beverage,
right? You know, it's like. So there's what's coming onto the market right now is a lot of like force carbonated, filtered meads that are made low alcohol, turned around in like 2 or 3 months, maybe less, sometimes 6 weeks. They're cheap. They pump them out. You get them in kegs. They're fast. I don't really like to drink them, but you know, if you're already drinking Angry Orchard and you're okay with that, then it's a pretty easy jump.
Yeah, and I would say also like. going back to my days in college, or a lot of homebrewers back then, the first thing they would make often is a mead, and you'd put it in like a Grolsch bottle, mm-hmm. so you could cap it off, and it would ferment in the bottle. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the kind of mead that a lot
bad.
Of people think of.
It yeah. probably wasn't bad.
It's an easy first homebrew.
Yeah, it is, and in a lot of ways, I mean, I make mead and not beer because I'm lazy. You know, like it's much simpler. It's much more low tech. I mean, you can do it with almost no equipment. We don't really filter anything. You know, we don't need that thing. You know, we're not adding any chemicals. You know, it's not really sterile. Like, I mean, we're making almost everything in wood barrels, so we rinse them out, but it's not like we have a big sulfite, you know, program or something like that. Which you can't say for beer, you know, everything has to be.
But that's important. We'll get to that too, because the whole natural wines thing, mm-hmm. that ties over to what you're doing.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question about mead production?
Sure, Matt.
Sorry, the voice from the booth.
What?
Who freaking him out in there.
I know, I was like...
Matt's our engineer who's also worked in breweries, so he's our secret wealth of knowledge.
Yeah.
When you mentioned, like, oh, there are no mead factories, I was just curious.
No, I mean, I'm just saying nowadays, yes, of course, we have a factory.
I get it, Yeah. Where so the only place that you frequently run into mead... Mm. Is at Ethiopian restaurants. Do you know where they get their mead? Are they making it?
I do know, actually. So this is a kind of point of contention. So in Ethiopia, so again, this is like back to your Dungeons and Dragons. One of the things I like to mention when people talk about mead, it's like, oh, they're thinking about Vikings, and it's like in D&D, which are, you know, basically more or less fictional characters. You know, most mead is drunk by black people in Africa, right? It's not like a Northern European like only drink. It's actually a worldwide drink.
Hey, there's a really well-known one we get from South Africa.
Sure. Yes.
The United. It's begins with an M.
Yeah.
That one. And someone has to Google that.
Yeah.
M mead from South Africa.
So traditionally mead in Ethiopia is called tej, and it's made with a plant like most meads, and it's with a gesher root. It's a stem, actually. It's like a bush. And I bought it, and I've, you know, tried to make it. You know, mead needs tannin. It needs a bittering agent to help clear the proteins and to preserve it, right? Like, the same way beer requires hops or something like that. The mead that's being sold in most Ethiopian restaurants is not tej. It's made by someone in New York. They're basically making a quick, sweet, clarified mead that's, you know, labeled as having like a Ethiopian recipe, but there's obviously no tej in it because tej has a flavor. So I haven't really seen any Ethiopian mead here in the States made with gesho root properly. So
that's a good question, man. Yeah. I never would have thought of Ethiopian restaurants as having mead. I guess I haven't been in a long time.
They do, but. You know, and actually the mead, what's interesting, it's like, you know, when I've talked to people from Ethiopia and people have had Ethiopian meads, it's a little bit like asking about after someone's sauerkraut. You know, everybody makes it a little different. You know, there's a huge range of kinds of things that they drink, that depending on where you are. Some of them has sorghum in it. It's more like a beer. I'd love to go to Ethiopia and try it myself.
And this, if you guys can Google, we'll bring it up.
Makana
from South Africa.
Is that, they did the chili one as well? There was somebody, right, had like a chili pepper.
I think that's actually a different one that might be called Ikalika.
Yes,
that
that's
one's quite
one.
Good. Yeah.
Yes.
But that, I think that's the same meter. Anyways, that's one example of through a really good importer, Be United, that's available as well from Africa.
And it's not bad. But, you know, I think... you know, for us, I think you can kind of tell one of the you know, because they make a dry mead that's quite nice. I think the fact that we do everything in wood really helps a lot, and I've noticed that it's kind of an advantage. Also, I'm not sure, one of the two South African meaderies innovated this inline fermentation system, which is really crazy and interesting. So it's not like they're actually feeding honey water into a tube, where it's being fermented by yeast that are like in alginate balls. So they basically live, there's like a tube, right? And honey water comes in and mead trickles out the other side.
So is that more of an industrial process, you're saying?
It is, yeah. And they've actually taken it on in Maine Meadworks, so they use the same process over there.
I think that's what your first question was, Patrick, is, you know, you're commercial because you have to be, you're a business.
Yeah.
But there's a difference in kind of more artisanal, small batch, versus an industrial processes.
It's not, you know, it's not even so much the process, it's the speed. Like, if you went to a winery in California and they said, like, yeah, we buy the cheapest grapes, we turn this around in 3 months, and then we sell it to you, no one's going to expect that to be good. Right? You know what I mean? It's, you can't cheat. Like, you just can't cheat. Like, stuff takes time. It doesn't taste good when it's fast. And one of the things that happens when you don't use some of these clarifying agents and when you don't filter and things like that is you have to wait for the wine to clear, like for all the kind of particulates and yeast to drop and things like that. And as a result, you know, our meads take a year. Now, I can get them out of the winery faster if I run them through a crossflow filter and, you know, I put them in a bottle really fast and I sulfite them. And also if it's, you know, maybe it doesn't taste so good, so I make sure it's pretty sweet when it comes out. You can cover up all your flavors. But when you make a dry mead, there's just no place to hide. So, you know, for all those reasons, we just kind of can't cut any corners.
And then more about Floralia.
Well, I had a question regarding a product that's not here tonight that we have sold of yours is called Knot.
Oh, yeah, the Knot. It's coming back.
It is coming back. Great. Okay. Which is only honey.
Right. It's just honey.
So, but my question there is you mentioned that it needs tannins to make it happen. So what are you doing to... What's going on with that those ingredients in the Knot?
So the knot, we basically get the tannins from the wood. So,
oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. So the Knot. So for people who haven't had it, the Knot is like one of our two flagship meads that we basically try and keep in production for the full year, but really it only lasts about 6 months. So, but it's going to come out again soon, I think, for the holidays. And that's just wildflower honey wine, wildflower honey. So this is a deep, rich, late-season honey. It's quite bitter, actually, and quite acidic.
It's delicious.
Some of the bitterness is going to come right out of the honey. These honeys that the Raise the Roof, that's the first honey out of the year. It's practically clear. It's not very bitter. So we're using that bitterness to help. And then there's also pollen in there. There's all kinds of stuff in there. We're using well water from upstate. The water is really critical. And if it wasn't, I wouldn't be driving up there tomorrow to fill up a bunch of barrels and bring them back down to the winery. So we use this very super alkaline water. And then
for all the meads or just for the Knot?
For all the meads that aren't fruit-based, yeah. And then we use...
So it's super alkaline water?
It's very alkaline. And I tried to use the New York water, but it's fine. It's fine, but it's not great. And you can taste it. You can taste the difference when you compare them. And then the other thing is then we put them in used red wine barrels. So we're going to get... They're neutral,
right.
Meaning so you're not going to get a big oak punch out of it. They're basically neutral, but they still release a little bit of tannin and stuff like that. And those combinations, also the micro-oxidation, and then also the... the fact there's actually quite a bit. They're usually pretty oxidized, so there's quite a bit of air.
So then Patrick, so with the Knot, that mead, how would you serve it?
That's one of my favorites. That's just left alone. I think it's fantastic on its own like that.
And a full pour, like how, are you serving it?
Six ounce
pour.
I would pour
8 ounce pour.
A full glass of it.
Yeah, five ounce. You know, at Honey's we do like a 4 or 5 ounce pour, like a wine glass. You know, that's another thing. It's like, you know, these kind of short meads and stuff, you know, they're half as strong, so people put them in beer glasses. But, you know, one of the reasons why it's so important to us to do a full 12% alcohol mead is because if you think about the way that mead might have been made for 10,000 years, you couldn't be making low alcohol meads. They just wouldn't keep. You know what I mean? It's a modern weird, it's like a weird kind of artifice of like, refrigeration and sterility and things like that you can have these low alcohol wines. Otherwise, they go bad really fast. So, you know,
I always thought it was the opposite. I thought that there would have been simple country wines that were like 9% that might have been on the verge of turning, might have been slightly sour.
You know, people weren't stupid back then. You know, they if they worked, they were very conservative about changing it because most things didn't work, right? So. Like,
I love that line. People weren't stupid back then.
No, it's really true. I mean, I think the longer you do any of these things, you know, especially when you're making alcohol and you know that, like, there's nothing you're doing now that someone hasn't tried in the history of humanity already. And then you go to some place and they'll make something in this weird way. Like, why do they use this plant? Like, Why are they putting yarrow in it? It's like, why are they, like, is it just because it tastes good? Why are they using the same plant across, like, 30 different cultures that have no contact with each other for the same thing? You know what I mean? Whether it's for herbal medicine or it's for a drink or whatever they're using it for. It's because, you know, they were smart and they figured out something that worked and that's why they do it. And it doesn't necessarily mean they know exactly why, from a scientific point of view, why they're doing what they're doing. But, like, you know, traditions that would, like, stir their wines with a stick and then they'd hang the stick on the ceiling and let it dry. And they'd always use that stick. You know, they don't have they didn't understand about yeast necessarily, but they knew that, like, if you use this stick, the wine would start up faster, right? And, you know, that's the kind of thing where it's like, or maybe there's some, like, quality of the wood itself, right, that isolates certain yeast and not other yeast and kills off the bad ones. Who knows? But often they're very smart about things. And, you know, even the shape of these vessels that they use, like these wine bottles, I mean, they're shaped like this for a reason. You know, they have a little neck, cuts down on the airflow, this little bottom part, the punt, you know, that's round here. It's to collect yeast along the edge. And, you know, no one mentions that to you at a wine shop, but you find out once you start making why they're shaped the way they are.
Patrick, you're moving your store down the street in Greenpoint, but you're going to add wine as well. So there's a lot of cool stuff that's going to happen with Duke's Liquor Box.
Correct. Right? Correct.
We're so we're going to take another short break. Just a quick note to our Untappd guy, Ethan. We are drinking beer as well. We have Arrowwood, which is a brewery in Accord, New York, upstate. We're drinking their Porch, which is a rhubarb wild ale. Is that right, Dylan?
Oh, wow.
All right.
Oh,
so we are drinking a beer, the Arrowwood Porch Rhubarb Wild Ale. All right. So we're taking another short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey, guys, it is New York Rye Week, and just so you can check it out, last year in November 2017, look up Beer Sessions Radio, episode 409. We did a really great show called New York Grains and Rye, the backstory of the Empire Rye, and we had a grain grower and some grains people as well as several distillers. So that's a great one. Episode 409, New York Grains and Rye, to learn more about Rye Week. Okay, here we are back with mead. Okay, Rafia. So we're talking about cool things that can happen and you know, arcane things like why your bottle is shaped this way.
Right, right. But you wanted me to go back to the, like, how we got to honeys, like, from where? So when I met you, I was doing mostly what...
So, like, 2009, 2010.
Yeah. So I was doing basically a subscription-based meadery. So, like, the reason why when I went to Patrick's, I said, you can have this and you can have this, but you can't have these, is because I hadn't really been wholesaling. Like, pretty much I had an email
list.
More
like a club, like a CSA
kind
of thing.
Yeah, it was, you know, we called it a community-supported alcohol. And, and, you know, it was... I liked, you know, I loved CSAs. I loved the model of the consumer-producer relationship. You know, that, you know, there's a kind of trust involved. And the idea was I would make, about 5 or 6 meads over the course of the year. And I'd send you a box every 3 or 4 months of a few meads. And I'd have a customer base. And that's what I was doing. And even today, we're still doing that. I just... we just released the newest CSA... box. And what's cool about it now is that in the old days, that was pretty much the only way to get the meat. And then if I had a little bit left over, I'd sell it to Duke's, I'd sell it to, you know, Byburn Bell, I'd sell it to you. Now, you know, we have a healthy wholesale, you know, thing. You know, we sell all over the city. We sell online. If you want any of these, you can get them on the internet at Enlightenment Wines. I'll put them in a box for you. I mail them to you almost any place in the world. And, but we're still doing the CSA. And what's cool about the CSA is that besides the fact that the members kind of get, you know, they get, you know, discounts and things like that, and it's cheaper and all that, they get a bottle of everything we make. So if we make, like, a really fancy little bottle and we only have, like, 100 of them, the CSA members get them first. So, for example, in this last release, about 2 years ago...
So that's the inside track to getting all your product.
Yeah, but also like the weird stuff that we don't sell at the bar even. So like 2 years ago, Japanese television came to do an interview with me, and they were like, we want to watch you make a mead. It was NHK television, which is like the PBS of Japan. And I was on the equivalent of like Good Morning America, right? So it's like a 3-minute spot. And we went upstate, and I picked a bunch of flowers. We picked some sumac, all this stuff. And then they made a little short, and I made a mead. But, you know, we couldn't drink it because it takes for a while. And 2 years later, I bottle it. I get like, I don't know what we got. You know, not that much. Not enough, certainly, to wholesale it. Not enough even for the bar. But enough for the CSA members. So all the members get a bottle. And it's got a cool sticker on it and shows, like, the NHK. And they can watch the video clip and... you know, that's sort of fun. Like when we did the, you wanted me to mention that maple, we did a maple wine aged in Tuttletown bourbon barrels for 2 or 3 years. And it was amazing. And I didn't really even, I don't know what I was doing.
You used maple syrup instead of honey?
Yeah, exactly. So we ferment the maple syrup. I put it in these bourbon barrels. I put it in the corner of the barn upstate and I forgot about it. And then, you know, 2 years later, I'm cleaning up and I'm like, oh yeah, what's this? And, you know, I got 20 gallons of this amazing stuff, but not a huge volume. Again, for our CSA members, and then we'd sell a few extras.
You know, I'm sucking down the Razor Roof, the sparkling.
Yeah, that's hard. We should try the dandelion before the show's over, because it's your favorite.
Let's pop that. And then I want to just ask you again, defining this, I'm glad we're having this conversation, because like I said, to me, mead was always, whether it's like the Dungeons and Dragons, something sweet, or even something that the home brewer would make for the first time. But you've elevated the game, and you know it again, Patrick, at your shop, you know, Duke's Liquor Box. Again, would you call these mead, or would you qualify it with another term?
That's a good question.
I don't want to call this the mead show. That's why we put it under like Rye Week and spirits.
Sure. Well, I think what Raphael said in the beginning of this was that almost nobody knows what mead is, yet everyone has opinion about it. Mm-hmm. And when nobody can see these because we're on the radio, but the packages are gorgeous. The labels are beautiful. They're very unique. They're mysterious in a way where it draws, if a customer is just browsing through our bottles, they're drawn to it. And often the conversation starts with, well, what is this thing with this label that has no information on the front? And we go, oh, well, this is mead and it's produced this way. And then they say, mead? Oh, it's made from honey. It must be sweet. Well, no, it's not. And we, you know, we get into the education of it all. Mm-hmm.
To his point, like, and this is, you know, a question for us too. It's like,
is it a fortified wine? You know, there's other,
well, there's a legal description of it, right, that the government says, and it's, you know, they tend to be wines. They're honey wines, but practically speaking, they can taste so, like this dandelion wine's a digestif. It's going to taste nothing like the sparkling mead you had, nothing like it. And maybe it shouldn't even be on the same place on the shelf, right?
Sure.
And so that's where...
So you're your own category. That's kind of what it is.
It is. And once we've got someone interested in it as a category, as a product, and they're trying to decide between, you know, which one of these four should I buy, it's you can't decide that way. They're all very different from each other, you know. So it's more about, well, what are you into, what's your flavor profiles that you like, and this and that. And so that's where we lead with it and go with it. But we do group them together in one section.
It's also, I kind of feel like this is sort of hard to describe exactly, but it's like a liminal drink, right? So it often is between categories. You know, if like, you know, in a world where
liminal,
like, you know, everything is gendered and it's like you're male or you're female. It's like, no, actually, there's all this kind of range to human beings. And it's like the same is sort of true for what we're making. It's like, there's a huge range to this stuff. And sometimes it's bitter and you sip it and you have a little glass. And sometimes it's big and it's sparkling and you have it in a big glass. And sometimes you eat it with dinner. Sometimes you don't. Sometimes you sip it on the porch. And there's everything in between. And I think that means... every bottle you sort of have to come to terms with on its own. It's not like there's a, like when you think about a beer and just like boom in your head, what's a beer? And it's like, okay, well, you have some idea and then you compare your beer that you're actually drinking against this sort of ideal version that you have in your head. If you have like, oh, you want a white wine, you want a Chardonnay, like here's the Chardonnay I made. You're going to compare the Chardonnay that you're drinking to some ideal version of Chardonnay. You can't really do that with what we're making, and that's why we make it that way. You know, every bottle is unique. they have their own collection of ingredients and techniques.
You're your own category.
Yeah, and so and every bottle I think really has its own thing to say, and that means you have to use your senses actually to do the analysis. Like, what does it smell like? What does it taste like? Do they fit together? Is there some consistency? Does it tell a story? You know, what's the finish like? Does it make me want to have more?
Quickly, all that. Let's just talk about you from, you know, making the wines on the farm to having Honey's, the bar and tasting room in Williamsburg.
Right.
Quick.
So, you know, I was doing the part-time thing, doing the CSA, but then feeling like I really needed to have a place in the city and I wanted to bring in partners. I brought in my partner, Arlie Marks, who is the... he set up the bar for Mission Chinese in the first edition over in the city, and is an old friend from Rhode Island and is a chef and a interesting drink guy. And also Tony Rock, who sort of retired and, you know, helps us with understand, you know, he's kind of the business guy, helps us like organize our finances. It keeps us from going out of business and, you know, keeps us like, you know, make sure we buy insurance and things like that. And helps us, you know, with the big decisions. And that's the team, basically. And then we've got a bunch of wonderful staff people, very talented people, and it's a little family. That's
so you've got you're showcasing your products. Are you making product there?
Or right. So if you come to Honey's, what you'll see is a bar, and next to the bar is the meadery, right? So the meadery has all the barrels in it. We're fermenting stuff in there. You can take a tour. You know, it's a full thing. We have a rooftop deck with a herb library and a garden. And then also, of course, Honey's, which is a cocktail bar. So we serve our own meads there and we make cocktails with them. But then we also have a full line of beer and regular cocktails and whatever crazy thing Arlie's working on.
And since Patrick's going to be there Thursday making cocktails.
Oh, and we're having a show on Thursday. So we're going to open up the winery. One of our bartenders is raising money for her thesis show at Hunter. She's an artist. So there's going to be a bunch of art performances and music, and I think it's like $5.
So there's stuff. But going back to the product, so what's your most popular or most interesting cocktail that you're making with your product?
Oh.
And then maybe Patrick's going to riff on that.
Oh, I don't even know. I feel like my favorite cocktail they took off the menu last summer.
That sounds like the one I want to hear about. Which one is that?
Well, we ran out of it. The St. Crimson Negroni I loved quite a bit. But, you know, the thing is, you know...
So what did you make that with?
Oh, God. Don't ask me this. No, I don't know, actually. I should have brought the menu with me. But we're doing the Chris Knife right now with the Dagger, which is really good, which I think is aged rye whiskey, but don't hold me to it. Yes?
Yes, it is.
Rye whiskey with the Dagger mead.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Yeah, that's really good. We do... I think a gimlet with this. I don't know. It's always kind of changing. That's the thing. It's like, it's not like we come up with a recipe and then that's all. No, we're done. It's like every year when the new mead comes out.
But it's an extension of you. Like the New Yorker said, instead of, it's not Dungeons and Dragons. This is like dry floral.
We have an incredible cocktail program.
Opportunity.
I think it tends to run dry. It tends to run with really, really interesting. And you know, the whole liquor program is really excellent.
Now, the dandelion wine, I've always liked this. It's something that I'm glad you keep making. I know you make small amounts. It's been one of my favorites for a long time. Patrick, what would you do with the dandelion wine? Because I like it just as a sipper. It's totally filling up my mouth with flavor. I don't have to drink too much of it. It's kind of coating my mouth.
Sure. And it's also nice and bitter at the finish, so I like it as a digestif for in place of a heavy amaro or something like that, because it's,
and dandelion's good for digestion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I
like it like that a lot.
We do it a brunch spritz. I mean, we don't do brunch, but you know, we've done spritz with it before, which is really easy with this, like lemon and honey and cava, and you're done. Yeah. And it's like a wonderful thing to have that's like kind of healthy and. You know, assertive, but...
So instead of one of those French elderflower things, sure, you put in this. This is an improvement already. It's not as sweet.
Yeah.
That is the other thing, is the level of dryness of your products, you know?
Right. Well, it's for two reasons. I think one is just biologically, if you leave any honey in there, if you're drinking sweet mead across the board anywhere, if you're drinking sweet wine more or less most of the time, you have to kill off the yeast somehow. You either have to filter it with a microfiltration so that there's nothing passes through, so you have a sterile wine, or you're going to need to pasteurize it, or you're going to need to sulfur it, or you're going to, you know, you got to do something. Otherwise, it's going to continue to ferment in the bottle. So we have to make dry meads so that they don't continue to ferment. The dandelion is the only exception to that. It has a little bit of residual sugar, and as a result, has a little bit of sulfites added to it to keep it from fermenting. But that's it.
And then we're going to have to close out soon. But Patrick, give us a plug on Deuce Liquor Box. What's your philosophy? Because you said for a while you were the only wine liquor store in New York State that only served spirits. What's your philosophy behind it? Because you're a destination spot.
Sure. I guess the really short mission statement or philosophy would be that we look at what we're selling not as an alcohol beverage within the industry. It's more of a food product, and that was our start from the very beginning. Was this is a food product. Why shouldn't we know what's in it, who makes it, and where it's made, what the ingredients are. And that was just a natural fit for Raphael and Enlightenment Wines and Duke's Liquor Box.
Great. And then so I can also order through you in New York City online?
Absolutely. Yes. At dukesliquorbox.com.
Great. And we brought a couple more things. Just give a quick plug. Mm-hmm. Some of the products you brought in that you sell at Duke's.
Sure. I just thought we'd bring something quite interesting. Being that it's usually first and foremost a beer show. I brought in a beer distillate, which is a Aventinus Edelster, unaged. So it's essentially it's essentially just a distilled beer, which.
But isn't that what they call whiskey before they distill it?
You're right, exactly right, totally right. Of course, as you mentioned, we're dealing with the federal government in the United States, and they want to categorize everything. But it is 100% a whiskey. Mm-hmm. It's made from grain, and it's fermented from grain, and then it's distilled. And if this was aged in a barrel, it would certainly qualify as a single malt whiskey. Mm. In the case of hops being involved, the federal government wants to call it a hop flavored whiskey in some instances. So there's guys in California. There's even folks at Arcane Distilling or now here in Brooklyn that are distilling a beer that Interboro.
Yeah, David. Distills right. Everybody's beers. And what's right, the second right. one you brought?
And the second one is it's an Italian grappa produced by a producer named Capovilla. It's a grappa produced from Amarone. Amarone is typically...
So it's a wine distillate.
It's a wine distillate.
Well, Amarone is a grape?
Amarone is a type of... It's almost more of a method. So Amarone actually means... I'm going to mess this up, but in Italian it translates to, I think, giant bitter or grand bitter. Mm. The technique is selecting grapes on a vine that are somewhat separated from each other so that they can lay them out on a straw mat, let them dry 2 weeks to 4 weeks, and it almost turns into
a
raisin.
It's like the Valpolicella is the base wine.
Exactly. So when you make a wine from that, what's left over is the pomace, and if you can imagine... Making wine from almost a raisin has got to be really difficult. Mm. Taking the leftovers and making a grappa is even more difficult.
Wow.
So he does that, produces a grappa, macerates tobacco leaves into it.
I want to try that.
Filters out the tobacco leaves. And then this is aged for 5 years.
It's got some color, too.
And we should totally try this.
I just want to say, this is what I expected, Raphael. Thank you so much, man. You're bringing in another outstanding industry guy, Patrick. Duke's Liquor Box. We're going to go over to Honey's. We're going to check it out. So happy that you got to come in. And I won't put you on Mead Day. I'll just put you on Enlightenment Wines Day.
Okay.
Because you are your own category, and I'm so proud of you. Really, you're impressing us always. But thanks so much again, and big shout-out to everybody, producer Justin Kennedy, our new intern Dylan, engineer Matt Patterson, and I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks for joining me here on the Heritage Radio Network. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right. Woo!
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.